Welcome to the final installment of ETIM Presents Power, Truth, and Suffering, Great Stories of Mishnah and Talmud. This time we're going to discuss the story of Dosa ben Hyrcanus and his meeting with the sages, reason versus revelation. This comes from the Gemara from Talmud Bavli, Yevamot, Yud Zayin Amud Aleph. I suspect the reason why this is among the stories that we've dealt, by far the least well known, it's partially because of its position in Yevamot, which is not nearly as popular on Masechet as some of the others, and certainly not in the Mishnah. And as a result of that, I think it's not that well known. There might be other reasons, because I think it's really a fundamental story that, like Tanur Shel Achnai, deals with the interrelationship between the founding fathers of the Tanayim, those who came together in Yavne, and along the way, also deals with the fundamental questions about the nature of Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral law, and how it's transmitted. So I think this deserves to be up on the high list, even if it doesn't generally get there. Now, the story starts dealing with the question of Yevamot. Says, V'nei Rabbi Dosa ben Hyrcanus, V'tiru tzaret habat l'achim. So that in the days of Rabbi Dosa ben Hyrcanus, the translation here is, the rival of a daughter was permitted to marry the brothers. Please do not play with the scroll, the screen, or play with the sizing, as it affects everyone's, and then I can't have the right text up when I'm talking about it, and that can be confusing. So please just allow me to navigate it, and don't scroll. Okay. Does everyone have the text in front of them? Bimei Rabbi Dosa ben Hyrcanus? In the days of Rabbi Dosa ben Hyrcanus? No. Let me try this. What about now? Yes. Okay. Okay, great. Thank you. Okay. So what does this mean? First, in terms of the halakha, what are we talking about? What's a rival daughter, and how is it permitted to marry brothers? So, as most of you are probably aware, in halakha, there's a law of yibum, that if a man passes away, leaving a wife, but no children, so the woman who's left, the widow who's left, is required to marry the brother of the deceased, her brother-in-law. Unless, or she has the right to marry him, really. And if he fails to do so, then he can dissolve this relationship, which they have by virtue of the fact that her husband and his brother died, through a ceremony known as chalitza. And then the woman is free to marry whoever she likes, and he is absolved of all obligation. Now, what happens if a man has two wives? Certainly permitted according to the Torah, and was permitted in the time of the Talmud. What happens then? And the answer is that the brother only has to marry, or really one of the brothers, let's assume in this case it's just one brother, the brother only has to marry one of these wives. And as soon as he marries one of these wives, or performs chalitza on one of these wives, then the other wife is once again free and clear, and is free to remarry whoever she chooses. Now, what happens if a man has two wives, one of whom is completely unrelated to him, but the other of whom is his niece, his son's daughter, his brother's daughter, sorry, his niece? According to the Torah, this is completely permitted. According to the rabbis, though not according to all Jewish groups in the ancient world, but according to the rabbis, not only is it permitted, but it's suggested, it's recommended. They thought it was a great idea to marry your niece. And there are several Gemaras, including one in Sanhedrin, which discusses the merits of marrying one's niece. Now, what happens then if that man passes away? Now, clearly, the brother cannot marry his daughter. That's prohibited. And there's no purpose in doing chalitza on the daughter. Now the question is, what's the status of the other wife, the tsara, what they call the rival? Does the tsara go free? Since her co-wife is now exempt from this whole deal, is therefore this wife also exempt from the whole thing? The whole thing just opens up just as if her co-wife had married the brother, she would be free. So too, when the co-wife is free from marrying the brother because she is the brother's daughter, so too, she is the second wife, the other unrelated wife, can also go free. Or do you say, no, this daughter does, the daughter, the wife was the niece, and the brother's daughter is not included in this whole thing. She's out because she doesn't enter into a whole conversation because she obviously can't marry her father. And therefore, and it's if the man left only one wife, the other wife, and she indeed has to either do Yibum or Chalitza with one of the brothers in order to be able to remarry. That's the halachic background to this. This question is the Machloket Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai, reported at the beginning of the Mishnah, the Masechet of Yevamot, and along with a whole bunch of other similar type cases. And this case, and Hillel rules that the brother must, the other wife is not allowed to, and therefore not required to marry her brother-in-law, because the daughter has permitted it by virtue of her being there. Whereas Beit Shammai holds that the daughter's, that the first wife, the niece, is irrelevant to the case because she, as we said, because she can't even begin to enter into this concept of yibam with her father, and therefore the daughter is permitted and required to marry the brothers, one of the brothers, in order or to do chalitza in order to be free. That's the case. Now, what about this statement? Who is Dosa ben Horkunus? So Dosa ben Horkunus we met already in the Mishnah on Rosh Hashanah about the dispute between Rabbi Yoshua and Rabbi Gamliel. Dosa ben Horkunus is the one who first raised the problem with this case where the moon suddenly disappeared after having been there. And he's the one who said, you can't give testimony that the woman gave birth, Machar Kreisa ben Shinyah. And the next day, her belly's still out to here. So we've seen him already. And he was one of a leading figure, an important figure, in the time of the Second Temple, the last generation of the Second Temple. And as we see, he survived until the period of Yavin. He lived through the destruction. He lived through the Great War, the Great Revolt. And at that point, as we'll see here, and as we suggested before, he was quite an old man. Now, what did this mean, Bimei Rabbi Dosa ben Horkunus, in the days of Rabbi Dosa ben Horkunus? Now, presumably that would mean in the days, in his prime, when he was truly active, in the days before the destruction of the temple. But why are we specifying him? Does this mean, why doesn't it say in the days of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, or Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel I? Why Rabbi Dosa ben Horkunus, who certainly wasn't the dominant figure of the generation? So, what does that mean? So, one possibility is to say that what it really means is that Dosa ben Horkunus himself actually was responsible for this ruling of Shehitiru Tzarat Habat Lachim, a ruling like Beit Shammai. But it never says that explicitly. The very opening line contains this ambiguity. It's not exactly clear what the relationship is between Rabbi Dosa ben Horkunus and Tzarat Habat. The story, we'll see different understandings of this line. Well, this line is almost interpreted throughout the story. Next, Hayad Hadavar Kasha L'Chachamim. This ruling was difficult for the Chachamim. And Mipnei Shechacham Gadol Haya Ve'inav Kamu Milavo LeBeit HaMidrash Amru Mi Yelech V'Yodiyo. So the rabbis were very unhappy about this. But because of the fact that he was a great sage, And also, since he was blind, enough kama, which recalls in different gears, different versions, recalls either the figure of Eli, who's blind at the end of his life, or the figure of Yitzhak. In both cases, people who are rendered impotent by their blindness and allow things to happen around them. And he is blind, and he does no longer go to the Beit Midrash. He's obviously an old man as well. So they said, who will go and inform him? Inform him of what? Clearly inform him of the error of his ways, that he has the wrong ruling. But more than that, I think the Yodio means, you have to check this more carefully, the implication is that they plan to excommunicate him, just as they excommunicated Rabbi Eliezer in the Tanur Shal. Amar lehen Rabbi Yoshua, ani elech. So Rabbi Yoshua got up and declared, I will go. Acharav mi, who next? Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. Acharav mi, Rabbi Akiva. So we have this very dramatic presentation of these three rabbis who are going to be the key players in this story. Each one, as it were, steps forward on the stage to introduce himself, to be introduced. And what we have here are three of the leading scholars of the period of Yavne, of the period of following the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. The main figure who's missing here, of course, is Rabban Gamliel. It's not clear why. Possibly because he is in charge, he's too high up to go on these sorts of missions, but it's not quite clear why he's asking for this. So now we have the whole setting and characters of our story. If we analyze this opening scene, we'll see that the whole story or the whole setup breaks into sets of two categories. When it comes to the characters, on the one hand, we have these three rabbis. On the other hand, we have Ridos and Horkinos. When it comes to place, we have on the one hand the Beit Midrash, which is the place of the three rabbis, and is not the place of Rabbi Dosa and Horkinos. He does not go there anymore. And on the other hand, we have, by implication, Rabbi Dosa's house, where he apparently remains, and this will become clear as the story goes on. And finally, time-wise, we have different times also. The story starts out being May Rabbi Dosa and Horkinos. But the story doesn't actually happen B'nei Rabbi Dosa ben Horkinos. It doesn't happen in his day when he was a dominant figure. It happens rather in the day of Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah and Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Yoshua. So time-wise, we also have the present, the world of Yavne, and the past, the world of Yerushalayim before the destruction. And everything breaks up very, very neatly here. And it's also quite clear where the center is. The center of gravity is with the rabbis in their Beit Midrash in the present time, in the age of Yavne. And Rabbi Dosa is sort of off to the side. He's sort of marginalized, as we suggest that the blindness seems to suggest also a certain lack of connectedness and a lack of control over his environment. So what happens to these three characters? Halchuv amdu al petach beita. Nichnisa shivchato, amra lo, Rebbe, chachmei Yerushalayim ba'im elecha, ba'in etzlecha. Amar la, yikansu, v'nichnisu. They went and they stood in front of the house, and his maid answered the door, and they went and she went to Rabbi Dosa and said, chachmei Yisrael are here. And he said, come in, and they came in. Now, one thing that we see from this scene is that, once again, the rabbis have this great status. They're referred to as Chachmei Yisrael. Those three, it's as if they represent all the wisdom of Israel, all there. And they are and they are given to enter. But really, the question is, what's this doing here? Most of the time, certainly in stories in the Gemara, and stories in Tanakh, but in many cases, even in much more detailed stories and novels or what have you, or movies, you never show everything. You never show every detail. Why do we have to stop at the door and watch them go through the door? Watch them pass through, knock on the door and go through. We didn't watch them as they went. We don't know how they went. We don't watch them on the bus as they sit on the bus and they get stuck in traffic. It doesn't matter. In a movie, you would just as easily cut from the Beit Midrash, cut to the scene in Ruby Dose's house. Why do we need to be told that they came in and the door was answered and we have to listen to the doorbell ring and all of that? What's its place in the story? Couldn't the story have just skipped over this without losing anything? We would have figured out by ourselves that obviously there must have been a door, and they must have gotten through, and someone must have answered the door, and someone must have said, it's okay, it's come in. So what? I think, on the one hand, this scene generates a certain amount of suspense. We don't know how Rabbi Dosa, who is, as we see, at odds with the rabbis on this crucial issue, we don't know how he's going to greet the rabbis. He might say, you guys can't come in. I don't want you guys. You guys have it all wrong. I'm not going to let you in to come yell at me. I don't need it. So they come in, and by standing at the door with them, and you see the shifcha, and the shifcha comes, and she goes, and only finally does she go and come back with the message. They finally enter. It builds up a little bit of suspense and allows us to wonder. And then the fact that Ridosa does, in fact, let them in, is perhaps emphasized, that he is, in fact, being nice to them, and that he is, in fact, giving them entry into his house. On another level, I think that the notion of the doorway here reflects something. Now, going through a doorway, crossing a threshold, always suggests a move between two different statuses or two different worlds. And here, when they cross the threshold, they're not just going into Rabbi Dosa's house. They're going into a whole different world, a whole different set of values and a whole different set of truths, ultimately. And by standing us and having us wait by the door and contemplate that, it's emphasizing the fact that they are, in fact, entering into this new realm. Okay. Tafsel Rabbi Yoshua v'hushigol mitashel zahav. So immediately, Rabbi Dosa takes hold of Rabbi Yoshua and seats him on a golden bed or a golden couch. So clearly, we see that not only is Rabbi Dosa accepting him, but she is accepting his guests, but he's treating Rabbi Yoshua with the highest accord. He's seating him on what's essentially a throne, and he's giving him great honor. But he recognizes the greatness and the importance of these rabbis, which we see is being sort of established and built up from the beginning of the story. But there's only one catch. Rabbi Dosa is blind. So he has no idea how many people have come to visit him. So, Rabbi Yoshua says to him, Amar le Rabbi, Amor le Talmidcha Acher, V'yeshev. You have to welcome in your next student, your next guest. Amar lo Mihu. Who is it? Who is this rabbi? Who is this who's come to visit me? He says, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, Amar, V'yesh lo ben la'azariah chaverenu, hara alav ha-mikra hazeh, nar hayiti v'gam zakanti v'lo ha-riti tzedek ne'ezav, v'zarom levak ha-shlachem, tafsel v'hushivo al-mito shel zahav. So, next, Rabbi Eliezer is introduced. Just like previously in the story, the three characters are introduced at the beginning. Who's going to come? Who's going to come? Who's going to come? Now, as they come into Rabbi Dosa's house, they're introduced one by one. And here he gets greeted, this warm greeting, more than just being seated at the end on the golden couch, but rather he says, is this really the son of my friend Azariah? He has this personal relationship with him, and he interprets this pasuk. He sees this almost as a sign of divine favor, that the tzaddik is never left. Who's the tzaddik? The tzaddik in this case is Azariah. That even Zarom Mevakesh Lachem, his son is not Mevakesh Lachem. He does not lack for bread, which in this case must mean Torah. That the son too is also a great Torah scholar, and he praises God for the fact that the Torah scholar was worthy of having a son who's a Torah scholar. And the issue of Elazar ben Azariah's lineage pops up elsewhere in other stories. Elazar ben Azariah was a direct descendant of Ezra. And his high lineage was important in the fact, in the story in which he gets appointed, at least temporarily, to be the head of the yeshiva, the head of the academy, instead of Rabbi Gamliel. Finally, we have our last guest. Amar le Rebbe, Amar le Talmidcha Acher Vashev. Once again, this clear structured, repetition. Amar le Yomihu, the exact same phrases. Invite the next person in, and he says, who is it? And he says, Akiva ben Yosef. Amar le, ata hu Akiva ben Yosef, sheshimcha olech mizof ha'olam b'yad sofo, shev b'ni shev, k'molcha yirbu b'Yisrael. You're the Rabbi Akiva, the Akiva ben Yosef, the famous Rabbi Akiva ben Yosef, who was known the world over, presumably for his scholarship and for his piety. Shev b'ni shev, sit down, please, my son, sit down. There should be many like you in Israel. Once again, he blesses him. He has this very warm, welcoming manner for these people, and not just welcoming, but deeply respectful. He sees these people as scholars. They're given these beautiful seats, and he sees, maybe even defers to their scholarship. Now, this scene of the welcoming of the three rabbis also emphasizes just how big the gap is between the world of Rabbi Dota and the world of the rabbis. Midos has not been in the Beit Midrash for us, and they are not in contact with him. There's a complete split. So much so that he doesn't even know that Rabbi Dos, that his friend Elazar ben Azariah has this son. He doesn't even know about this. Elazar ben Azariah supposedly was a wunderkind, so maybe he could be 16, 18, but still, it's been a long time, and he doesn't even know that this son exists. And similarly, Akiva, also he's never met. Rabbi Akiva is the great Rabbi Akiva. Now granted, so maybe he came to the Midrash at a later age in life, so even if he was older, he would have come after Rabbi Dos's retirement, as it were. But still, he's never seen him. He's never heard him. So there's no, he's only heard of him. So the gap between the Beit Midrash and the house of Rabbi Dosa is really quite significant. There's really no communication and no interaction. It's not just that he doesn't get to the Beit Midrash that often. He has no idea what's going on there. And on the opposite, as we'll see, they have no idea what's going on with him. A complete separation. Okay. Hichilu mistavvin oto bahalachot. Ad shegiu l'tzarat habat. So here it translates that they began to address him with all sorts of questions on legal practice. But the literal meaning is, misavivim oto b'halachot, means to surround him with halachot. And the sense that you get here is that the rabbis are in control. They're moving from topic to topic. Rav Dosa has no idea what their point is, if they have any particular point. And when they get to Tzarat Habat, he doesn't realize that this is a matara, this is the whole point of the conversation. This could just be another issue which has sort of been hidden. But the reader, along with the rabbis, shares the rabbi's knowledge for Bidosa lacks. And we know why they're here. And we know that their real point is to meet Rabbi Dosa, is to catch Rabbi Dosa on this question of Tzarat Habat. So we have the sense that the rabbis are in control, they're manipulating the whole conversation. Rabbi Dosa just thinks it's an innocent conversation. In fact, it's an inquisition of sorts. Amulei Tzarat Habat Mahu. They asked him, Tzarat Habat Mahu. Now, the entire story up to this point leads up to that question. The whole point was that they were going to go and confront Rabbi Dosa over this issue of Tzarat Habat. And now we're waiting for him to say what we know he has to say, that the halacha is like Beit Shammai, because we know already that fact. We thought that fact's been stated by seemingly an objective narrator, and everyone takes it for granted. But what happens? Amar lehen machloket Beit Shammai Beit Hillel. Once again, we have a doubling. We don't get there. The suspense is built up. He's ambiguous. He says, oh, that's a machloket. He doesn't take a stand on it. He seems like he's being diplomatic. He doesn't want to be caught holding like Beit Shammai. And he thought he could just say, well, it's a machloket. It's a dispute. Beseder. So they ask him, halacha kedivrei mi? Amar lahem, halacha kebeit Hillel. Bang. At this point, the story has now completely shifted 180 degrees on its axis. The balance of power has completely changed. Because until now, we were with the rabbis, and we were sure that we knew what was inside Rabbi Dosa's head. We were sure that he was sided with Beit Hillel. And we were sure the rabbis knew what they were talking about. That Rabbi Dosa sides with Beit Shammai. But all of a sudden he says, halacha kebeit Hillel. Whoa, what's going on? This is the total surprise, which all of a sudden shows that the rabbis have been working off a false premise the entire time. They haven't known what they were doing. And really, as we'll see, it's Rabbi Dosa who is the knowledgeable one, who is the knowing one, who understands the halacha and understands what halacha is all about. And it's these people who came to tell off Rabbi Dosa, who in fact are students, as they referred to themselves perhaps a little bit ironically previously, they are the Talmidim, and they need to learn from him.
make this a little smaller. Okay, they say, Amar Lei, Valo Mishimcha Amru Halacha Gebet Shammai. They said, but we heard it. We knew it was Halacha Gebet Shammai. All of a sudden, they're totally lost. They don't have all the answers. They're asking honest questions, trying to get answers from him. How could it be that we heard in your name? They say to him, Amar Lehem, Dosa Shamatem, Uben Harkinas Shamatem. What did you hear? Did you hear Dosa? Or did you just hear my last name, Ben Harkinas? Amar Lei, Chayai Rebbe, Stam Shamanu. You just heard Ben Harkinas, without any first name. Now we realize the rabbis have not properly interpreted, have not properly understood the tradition which has been passed down to them. They lack knowledge. They lack understanding. And what were they missing? Amar lahem, ach katan yeshli. I have a little brother, Bechor Satan hu. He is a Bechor Satan. Here they say a daredevil. I don't know why it would be a daredevil. Literally, as it says, it's Satan's firstborn. He's Satan's spawn. He's almost some sort of monster. And the Yonatan Shimon, his name is Yonatan. And he is a student of Beit Shammai, and the implication is he is the one who said this. But the rabbis, because they lack a proper connection with Rabbi Dosa and with the previous generations of rabbis, rather so they, in their time, were the center of things, not the older generation. Because of that, they weren't able to interpret this properly. They weren't even aware of rabbis who were still around, as we see, who could have said things. As a result of that, they aren't able to properly process the Torah that they've received. Because they have not properly the proper deference and proper concern for the way in which things have been passed down and connecting themselves to the previous generations so they can understand what's being passed down. And then he says, Hizaharu shelo yikapeach echem b'halachot. Lefi sheyeshimo shlosh me'ot shuvot betzaret habat shumimutaret. And he says that beware of him, watch out for him, because he will conquer you, he will beat you in a combat of Torah, overwhelm you, it says here, with halachot, with arguments, that he has 300 different arguments, answers, as to why tzaret habat should be mutar, why the halacha should be like Beit Shammai. So now it seems that Beit Shammai, Beit Shammai, its representative Yonatan, is rooted in svarot, is rooted in arguments. And they're so skilled with these arguments that they could crush even these great rabbis, and there's no way to beat them. And they will convince you that the halacha is this way, even though, as we'll see, it is not. Now, this whole image of Yonatan, Yonatan ben Harkinus, who I think appears only in the context of this story, I find very striking, almost something mysterious, and as I said, there's almost a Bechor Satan, there's something almost monster-like. And the way he warns them, be careful, he will get you. Don't try to fight him. Just avoid him. I mean, what it reminds me of most is the Jabberwocky. Beware the Jabberwock, my son, the jaws that bite, the claws that catch. Beware the Jub-Jub bird and shun the Frumious Bandersnatch. Listen, there's this monster roaming around the forest, and you've got to be careful. And if you don't, he's gonna eat you, and you're gonna be in trouble. Now at the end of this whole series, my reason for bringing in these various cartoon characters, as it were, from comics and cartoons, Superman and the Jabberwocky and Mickey Mouse and what have you, is not just a shtick. It's not just a way of getting people to remember the shear because they'll have some visual image which they'll associate it with. Rather, I really believe that there's an element in these stories which are fundamentally about rock-solid day-to-day life, about halakha, about how we work in the world, about politics, about existential issues, issues of emotions, and how we relate, as we saw in the story of... please don't play with it. No, you don't have the whole poem, I'm sorry. with all that realism, which halakha commits us to, there's also this image of play, which in the story is an issue, extent of the fantastic,
which is very much reminiscent, much more of a world of Superman, of the Jabberwocky, than it is of realistic novels or serious films. And I don't really know the significance of that or how it works or why it works, but I think it's an important aspect of these of the stories in Chazal, that they have this element to them. Okay. What does he say next? Dosa says, "Aval meir ani alai shamayim va'aretz, heaven and earth are my witness. Shal meducha zu yashav Chagai ha-Navi v'amar shlosha dvarim." That Chagai ha-Navi himself sat on the chair. It says the mortar. It's another place that suggests that's a saddle. One way or another, it's a very simple chair, not very comfortable chair. And he said three things. Sarat habat is asur. Amon Moav ashim maser ani b'shviit. Amon Moav take maser ani in shviit. Mekablim gerim min ha-kurim min ha-tarmudim. And we accept gerim from these two different tribes, from what I understand, had a doubtful status. Some people thought they, in fact, were descendants of Jews and were, in fact, all mamzerim, and therefore, there's nothing you could do about it. You couldn't marry them. And they said that they were. So we have this series of rulings, essentially opening up possibilities defining possibilities in terms of the borders of the line of Israel, in terms of the borders of the Jewish people, and also in terms of the contours of the family. But what's the nature of Vidosa's argument? Vidosa says that my brother has rational arguments, svarot, reasons, why the halacha should be that way. And you're not going to beat them. They're rock solid. No one's going to come up with a better argument. But it doesn't matter. Because I have something much more valuable than this. I have misora. I have received this. I have received directly from Chagai HaNavi, among the last of the Nevi'im, who in turn means ultimately going back to Har Sinai. And I received this directly from him. And because of that, I know this halacha is correct. So what you have is these two different possible approaches to halacha. One which is more rational, one which is about making arguments and proving things, and the other which is about receiving. And Rabbi Dosa says that the halacha is like receiving. And in doing that, he's delivering a powerful blow to the rabbis. Because even though he's proven to the rabbis that their halacha is true, he's also shown that the rabbis don't really understand the basis of their halacha. They thought it was all about themselves, about their arguments. And therefore, they could go and tell off the older generation if they think they got it wrong. But really, it's all about Misora. Their problem is that they were not connected to the previous generation. They weren't in contact with Rabbi Dosa. They never went to him to receive these traditions. They never knew enough about the earlier generation to properly interpret things, and therefore misunderstood what they had received. And as a result of all of that, they nearly came to this terrible conflict with Rabbi Dosa. Rabbi Dosa here, the meducha, this sort of overturned stone bowl which he's sitting on. So at first it looks like the rabbis are sitting on these golden thrones, and he's sitting on this little stool. It looks like, well, who's important? Obviously people want the golden thrones. But in fact, this humble stool is more important and shows more authority than the golden thrones, because this humble stool means that he sits in the seat of the prophets. He has a direct tradition. He speaks for the prophets. And speaking for the prophets, he is able to transmit this halacha. So the story, in the end, it turns out that Rabbi Dosa is the carrier of wisdom. It's not the person who has to be told off, but he's the one who has all the information and is telling off the other rabbis. And the rabbis are the ones who need to learn still. And this, I think, is a crucial point about the nature of a lot of rabbinic stories. But the great rabbis, Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Yoshua, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, don't simply teach us because they're so smart, because they know so much, and therefore, in these stories, they tell us all these great things. But rather, they tell us things because, like us, they are ignorant. And we learn not from them, but with them. As they go through life, they learn more things. And they are open to learning more things. They're open to transformation. And they're open to education. And in this case, they find out that they were completely wrong. And they misunderstood what it meant to be a true student of Hillel. and what it meant to and what it meant to defend his positions, that it meant defending tradition, being connected to tradition, and they get all messed up because of it. So a classic rabbinic story, unlike I think in most religious traditions, is in fact one where the rabbi learns something, but even the rabbis have something to learn, and then we can learn with them. Now, then there's like a sort of epilogue to the story. Tana. When they entered his house, Rabbi Dosa's house, they all came in together like a force, like an army. But when they left, they scattered as if they were in retreat through three different doors. They just ran out. They were completely shattered. Once again, this notion that they'd been beaten, they'd been vanquished. But then something even more happens. Wait. Lost the screen. David in Tel Aviv, did you hit something? We have to get back the text. Okay. I think everyone should have it now. Does everyone have it now? Okay. So, this image of they've been scattered like the wind. But what happens? Pagabo the Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva meets him. Who's him? Comes clear from the context. Him is none other than the feared Rabbi Yonatan ben Harkins. And I always have this notion, this image of him meeting in a dark alley outside, not far from his house, not far from Ridos's house, as he's wandering around in this strange town trying to find his way home. Akshileva Ukne. Immediately, losing no time, he throws out questions to Rabbi Akiva, attacking Rabbi Beit Hillel's position, and he silences him. He makes him stand. He stands dumb. He completely overwhelms Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva, the great dialectician, the great creative thinker of halacha, is suddenly stopped cold in his tracks by this figure of the previous generation. By this Rabbi Yonatan ben Hercules. He says to him, and I see this picture him saying in this really sort of, I don't know about evil voice, but certainly sort of a cynical voice. He says, Atahu Akiva Shimcha Lech Misofo V'Alam V'Ad Sofo. You're the Akiva whose name goes from one end of the world to the other. The same words that his brother used to praise him, he now uses to attack him and to put him down. You're lucky you have that name because you don't deserve it. You don't even reach the level of a cowherd or an oxherd, a cowboy. He says, not even that of shepherds. So this code out of the story reemphasized that the rabbis weren't up to either side. They didn't have the mesorah of one brother, nor did they have, were they up in terms of rational arguments to the other brother. But they just get crushed on both sides. Interesting question, what happened if all three of them had taken him on? The notion that gets caught lost with this terrible adversary. I think works very well in the story. And he says, in Rabbi Akiva's response, not even a roet son, Rabbi Akiva accepts this. He says, no, you're 100% right. Once again, it's this willingness of the rabbis to learn, his willingness to accept their inferiority, which is precisely what makes them great. And of course, the notion of the Ro'eit Son is might well connect to the fact that Rabbi Akiva, according to some accounts, in fact, began his career as none other than a Ro'eit Son, than a shepherd. And shepherds are the absolute lowest level of society in Chazal. Though I just saw a very big scholar claim that wasn't necessarily true. Certainly, according to some sources, there's nothing lower than a shepherd. And part of the reason for that is that shepherds are considered to be thieves. They're the next thing over to thieves. They're sort of on the borderline of legitimacy within the society. They could sort of keep their head open. They could appear in the open. They weren't like thieves who live in the shadows, but they weren't really much better. And the reason for this is that goats and sheep will eat anything. And the temptation when herding, herding your sheep, and I've seen this by my own house, that the sheep will come, and it's much easier to let the sheep graze a little bit into someone's land as opposed to remaining in the public pasture than to actually try to control them and stop them from eating up all this stuff. So Roei Tzon, among other reasons, are considered this very low level. Rabbi Akiva started there, and the notion that Rabbi Akiva hasn't gotten anywhere since then. It's very sobering that he hasn't really accomplished anything. Once again, it's this willingness to recognize inferiority and ignorance that precisely defines the rabbis. Can we get the text up? I didn't able to see the text. I don't know how they did that. There we go. Are there any questions? Are there any questions? Can you hear me now? Can you hear me? Can anyone hear me? Have you all heard the whole shiur, even? So are there any questions? No questions at all? Have any Yisrael and Pesach? Oh, Aaron, good. Yeah, Aaron's question is interesting. That generally speaking, there is a sense that in Bavel, where this story comes from, there is a valorization of svara, of argument and dialectic. And here the story seems to come, out against this sort of thing. And it is interesting to try to figure out what this story meant within the context of Bavel, that they were telling such a story. The story does seem to be sort of a counter voice against perhaps the prevailing norm, which seemed to value that. But we see that that elsewhere, I believe the Gemara also favors Sinai versus Oker Haram, which is the similar type of notion. It favors that broad knowledge of details rather than intellectual agility and sharpness. So you see such things. But yes, it is important and be interesting to try to really fully work out what its connection is. Any more questions? Okay, so unless something pops up, thank you very much for participating. I enjoyed the whole series. I hope you did as well. And hope you have an opportunity to do this again. Take care. Bye.